Greg Gutfeld. Welcome to The One. I'm The One, Greg Gutfeld. I'm very excited about today because my guest is a good friend of mine, Dr. Mark Siegel. He is an associate professor of medicine at NYU Langone?
NYU Langone.
Oh, I've already screwed things up. Anyway, and he's the medical director of Doctor Radio as well, right, Doc?
Yes, sir.
And he's a Fox News contributor. And Dr. Siegel writes a lot. He writes a lot about two O's. He writes about opioid drug abuse and Obamacare. They both begin with the letter O, and only one of them actually works. And I'll let you know which one I think. But, you know, I want to talk to you. I could talk to you for hours about this issue because I don't know where to go with this opioid epidemic. And there's a lot of bills being passed in different legislatures, different state legislatures. There's a bill that is allowing involuntary commitment for addicts. I think that's in Wisconsin. And the reason why these bills are happening, Doc, is because people are seeing a lot of overdoses, a lot of abuse. It's safe to say it's a problem, right?
I would, and I like the word epidemic, and in a way it connects your two O's. Just briefly, let me say that the one thing that I actually like and is worth saving about the Affordable Care Act, so-called, is the fact that it covers the opioid epidemic. It covers addiction services. And what I mean by an epidemic is that opioid use spreads.
Right.
If you're using it, the next guy may be using it. And if I'm not prescribing it, you may be getting it illicitly somewhere else.
Right.
You know, fentanyl's coming across the border, and it's killing people.
Right. Now, this is the thing that I get it. You know, I live in New York City. I'm not sure if it's opioids or what, but there are people that are addicted, and I see them on the street. And they're usually at methadone clinics. And I think that as long as there is pain in life – whether it's psychological pain or physical pain, people are going to look for things that remedy their pain. And I don't think you're ever going to be able to get rid of it. Although I understand that doesn't mean you just ignore it. So I guess my problem is we have this tendency to demonize the substance that seems to be spreading because it's effective, because it makes people feel better, when we should really be looking at how can we have both? How can a population deal with something that works so well that they abuse it? Like, there are so many things people abuse because they just make you feel better. So how do you deal with that? Did you follow me?
Yes, and I have many answers to that. But let's start with a boring one, which is I should not put my pen – or in these days, my computer, to a prescription, Greg, unless I can justify it.
Right.
So it starts with me.
Right.
I mean, you could say, oh, it's the pharmaceutical industry, or it's the pharmacies, or it's all the pressure I get from the patient. It's still me.
Right.
Even if I have 100 varieties that I can prescribe, and even if the patient is doing what I call the by-the-way prescription, where they're leaving and I'm on to the next patient. Hey, doc, you forgot to give me my Percocet prescription.
Yeah.
It's still me.
It's still you.
And then there's guys like, you know, some doctor allegedly in New Jersey prescribing 66,000 opioid prescriptions in 1 year to patients he never met.
Well,
wow. So there's a few of us that are the worst, but the Institute of Medicine said about 15 years ago that there are 100 million Americans in chronic pain. That's to your point.
Right.
But it doesn't mean, even if that's true, even if we were underappreciating pain previously and now we're on to pain, It's a fifth vital sign. We're on to it. Doesn't mean that this is the effective way that we should be treating it.
You called it the fifth vital sign. What does that mean? I've heard that before. Is that – the fifth vital sign is that like the pathway to the pain medications? It's like they're treating it like a vital sign?
Exactly. You know, patient walks in the door, you know, how are you feeling? What's your blood pressure? What's your heart rate? And are you in pain?
Yes.
So I'm asking it right off the top. And patient may not even be in pain, but they feel a little pain because their girlfriend broke up with them.
Right.
And they say, yes, I'm in pain. So, you know, and then the other thing is that over the years, we have had more and more treatments for pain that are non-opioids.
Right.
There are drugs like tramadol out there. There's a drug called Lyrica out there. There's muscle relaxants. The other rule that I would say in medicine, Greg, is not only are you responsible if you prescribe something? You're also responsible for figuring out what the problem is.
Yeah.
You know, don't just throw an opioid at it. Why is the patient in pain? What's the reason? What's the diagnosis?
You know, when we did a segment last week on the five, and it was about opioid. No, it was driving while drugged, while being impaired, and the study found that drugs in the system had overtaken alcohol in the system of fatalities. And I read the study, and I realized that there were a lot of problems with it. They didn't specify in over half the medications what the medications were. So it was, pot was like 35%, which was less than alcohol, which was 37%. And they couldn't – they also didn't say whether or not alcohol and drugs were in the system together. So I found it to be troubling. But what I thought was interesting was the letters that I got afterwards from viewers who were saying, because of your coverage on opioid epidemics – I can't get my drugs, and I suffer from – and it was a myriad of disorders that people had mentioned to me, some I'd never heard of. And they said, I'm in absolute pain, and because your network and other shows and they say that this is a problem, I'm treated like a criminal. Do you understand? Do you follow that when I'm saying – you know?
Yeah, in fact, I saw several of those emails that you received. You were nice enough to share them with me, and I have a response to that, which is – they're actually right. Mm-hmm. They're right that there are real indications for opioids. Mm-hmm. They're right that there are some conditions that require it. They're right that when all else fails, it may be the only thing left.
Yeah.
They're also right that we're being clamped down on as physicians.
Yeah.
But you know what? They're not right that they can't get it at all.
Right.
And so I think the pendulum is swinging in the right direction, but I have to make sure,
right.
And you do make sure. You're very compassionate about this issue. I have to make sure to add in the caveat, yes, there are indications, but too many times we're not using it appropriately.
You know, remind me about the word indications, because I have a theory, doctor, that I don't think anybody's ever brought up in the history of opioids and pain. And I think either I'm nuts or I might be onto something. Remind me of that. First, I want to ask you about risk. Okay, so the risk argument with drugs that work. Opioids are so effective and people like them so much that there's a risk of overdose. I'm running into people like I read an article by David French in National Review saying that this is why all drugs should be illegal or whatever, or narcotic drugs should be illegal. We don't make that argument with guns or cars. Imagine if every article about cars just focused on car accidents. Like you want to read about a new car, they just show you how many people died that year. Or if you want to go buy a gun, you look up articles and all there are articles about suicides and accidents. That's how drugs are portrayed in the media, because the benefits of drugs are so boring. Like nobody wants to read about a plane landing safely. They want to read about the plane crash. Nobody wants to read about how these drugs help people, but the overdose story, which is a small piece of this story, is what gets the news. And I worry that we demonize – we don't do this with guns, especially here at Fox News. You know, we're all Second Amendment. So when somebody talks about suicides, we go, well, that's a risk that we will take with guns. Auto accidents. You and I both know people that have died in car accidents, yet we still drive. You and I probably know somebody who was in a plane who died in a plane accident. I had a grade school friend die in a plane crash. I still fly.
And we only demonize plane flights, of course, when there are terrorists involved.
Exactly. So it's like the risk argument, why doesn't it apply here where you go, yes, there are overdoses, but in the overall scheme of things, it benefits 100 million people, just like driving benefits 300 million.
So I have an answer to that. Yeah. The first thing is education. I'd like it if doctors were more educated about the proper use of opioids. Not that they don't have uses. They do have uses. But the idea that they suppress breathing. So,
yes.
You know, you shouldn't take them without knowing that they suppress breathing.
Right.
And that not everybody, but many people require more and more to get the same effect.
Yes.
So that's addiction. So the problem with addiction, and I'm not stigmatizing addiction. The problem with addiction is it risks breathing.
Yes.
So that's the overdose part.
That's how
of it.
People die.
Yeah.
They just stop breathing because they're so relaxed, or is that what happens when you're on
opioids? No, it literally suppresses the respiratory right. center. But look, here's an example how it happens, and you'll understand my compassion on this side of it. I give somebody a Percocet prescription, let's mm-hmm. say, because they had an operation. Mm-hmm. And then I give them a couple refills. Then they don't have them anymore. They don't want to, they're too embarrassed to go to me. So they get some fentanyl that come across the border that's 80 times more powerful
wow.
than heroin.
Yeah.
And they take too much of it, and it suppresses their respiration
right.
center. So that's the issue. But you brought up a really good point here, which is let's deal with this in a way without making people feel bad about
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. It's like, and that's where I'm coming to some kind of weird realization as I grow old. By the way, I just want to question about fentanyl. Who would need something that powerful recreationally? I mean, fentanyl, I think my dad might have had it years ago when he had cancer. I don't think it's a new drug.
No,
because
in fact,
it sounds familiar.
It's got a great use, as a matter of fact.
What?
It's used as a patch when you have cancer, something to give
yes.
give you release over 48, 72 hours.
Yeah, I think my dad had it, and before he died, and both of my parents, you know, had to deal with pain from cancer, and I saw how these medications helped them.
Hugely important.
Yeah,
hugely important.
Yeah, but the fentanyl, I'm like going. It's like you hear that it's like 80 times or something like that. Why? How can somebody take that recreationally? I don't understand.
Well, because there's two different types. There's the type that I use medicinally. That's
yeah.
not 80 times. The
yeah.
type I'm talking about is the type leaking across the border that some chemist down there in Mexico or somewhere is making deliberately 80
yes.
times more
wow.
so that they can get a potent buyer.
See, this is interesting to me about the idea of how things are packaged. Like, for example, when you buy a pack of cigarettes, it's 20 cigarettes. It's not one cigarette with 20 times the power. And I think always the problem with drugs and illegal drugs is is how it's concentrated. That if cocaine were legal, you could buy 20 cocaine cigarettes and you could smoke them 4 or 5 throughout the day. You'd be as high as anybody on Adderall temporarily. But because it's illegal, you've got people in bathrooms snorting cocaine and baby laxative and crapping their brains out in a dive bar.
Yeah, that's a great point. No.
Sorry.
And it's also cheaper. And by the way,
yeah.
it's a good time to bring up the point that 4 out of 5 heroin users start out with guys like me giving
yeah.
them a Percocet prescription. So I'm a gateway.
Yeah.
I'm an enabler.
Right.
And I'm an enabler to very cheap stuff you buy in a bag on the corner.
Yeah.
That's dangerous. And it's a culture.
Mm-hmm. It's I find it's weird because like I've been reading up on this and there's research that – there was a study that I came across about –
by the way, Greg, it doesn't cause diarrhea. It causes the opposite.
Oh, yeah. No. Opioids cause the opposite, but cocaine laced with baby laxative will cause diarrhea. Not that I would know. I just remember walking into Hell's Kitchen bars and the smell in the bars. I go, that's not normal. And I always knew it was a drug bar because if you walked in the bathroom, they had just cans of Lysol just stocked up. It was usually a rock bar with a pool table. Anyway – that was years ago. I'm talking 20 years ago. I don't go to those bars anymore.
They haven't changed.
No, they haven't. So I came across this amazing study. It was on OTC painkillers, Tylenol. And they found that people that took Tylenol for physical pain saw a reduction in what's called social pain or psychological pain, mental pain, like you know when you said breaking up with a girl or a guy or whatever. And the conclusions were that social pain and physical pain employ some of the same pain equipment in the brain, that they kind of come from the same place. So this is why I had this idea or theory that the reason why opioids are so phenomenally popular and so big is that they're not just dealing with physical pain as much as dealing with the psychological pain, which once dealt with dramatically boosts well-being so that it actually reduces the other kind of pain. But I'm beginning to think that the reason why it's popular has nothing to do with physical pain. It has something to do with just the way life is. And when you have people pick different agents to deal with their own suffering in life, whether it's a martini when they get home from work, they have 2 martinis, or maybe it's pot.
Something to distance yourself from the reality. By the way, you're onto an extremely important scientific point here when you say that the addiction centers that are psychological and physical are very close together. And scientists now, geneticists, are working on painkillers that are going to be the next generation that won't give you the psychological addiction.
Right.
Not to the same extent. And that may be what I'll prescribe in the future. I wonder if it'll be as popular. But I can get the same effect on pain
right.
without the same addiction.
But what happens, okay, this, you know, you hear about accidental benefits of medications, like and that side benefit becomes a primary action. Like Viagra, was that a blood pressure medication?
Very funny story about that. And by the way, I love that story because it shows that a lot of our great discoveries occur in drug company labs, not
absolutely.
In academia the way that everybody always
absolutely.
Thinks.
Absolutely. The drug companies unfairly demonized because that's where the breakthroughs are.
Greg, a lot of times it's outside the box thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who invented Zithromax, a chemist, told me, hey, I just happened to study tissue levels and the thing lasted. So I was able to use it for 5 days and bang, I made $1 billion. Or with Viagra.
Yeah.
Some nurses were observing these guys
right.
for blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
and they suddenly noticed their towels were going up.
Yeah, no, it was like they were having the side effect, and so then they that become so that is where so when I'm looking at this at opioids, and I'm going like you just said create a painkiller that is separate from the psychological addiction. If you separate it from the psychological addiction, that means you're removing the psychological benefit of it. My argument is why? Why not create the psychological benefit drug
okay.
and treat things like – and I this is where I'm going off into non-science land. Why are we using Prozac and other drugs for depression when a painkiller can have the same effect on the psychological pain? Why can't – why – I know because it's addicting. You're not addicted
right.
to Prozac.
And the breathing issue.
Yeah.
But right, otherwise I'm totally with you on that. I think that you get side effects from things like Prozac that you really just don't need.
Right.
They affect libido, they on and on and on.
Yeah.
I'm for using some of the benefits of painkillers for getting rid of psychic pain, whatever that is,
yeah.
but without the physical addiction part of it. And that's where we're heading.
So
that's
what
where
about
we're heading.
What if the addiction part is a reality to everything? Whether it's alcohol, like there are people that can drink a martini a day, but then there's somebody that overdoses at a frat party because they did 17 shots in a bet. We can't correct for everything, right?
And by the way, this is a point I almost forgot to make. Doctors are not judges.
Yeah.
I don't want our listeners to think that I'm judging anybody
right.
here because you're absolutely right, and you made this point earlier. There's nothing evil about opioids.
No.
There's nothing that tells me someone's going to be addicted to it and somebody won't.
Yeah.
Same with alcohol. What is important is that as a physician, I prescribe responsibly.
Right.
And that I keep track of these things. So there's no all or none.
Yeah.
There's times when I need to prescribe this stuff.
Yeah. It's just it just seems to me that like you can't in an effort to eliminate risk. There are certain things in life that we lose out on. And I think about – and you might know this better than me because I'm always working secondhand with the stories about MDMA. But that MDMA or ecstasy began for marriage counseling. And it was supposed to be incredibly earth-shattering that like they could perform in a day.
This is true.
On marriage counseling with one hit of MDMA that would take 3 years of therapy. But nobody studies that anymore because the drug was demonized and now is illegal, so we don't do research on it. Is that
same with ketamine?
Yeah.
The same thing with ketamine, which is a great anesthesia drug,
yes.
which we found may be useful at breaking depression cycles, but it's been demonized.
I've read up on the ketamine stuff, and it is incredible. This and it's like this is what I worry about opioids is that we're going in that direction with another medication that helps so many people when I feel like we should be going backwards and looking at MDMA, looking at effects of marijuana. There was a great study I have here that you probably know about. It came out last year. You can tell I've been holding all of this information on for so long.
Because the cannabinoid receptor in the brain is hugely important and should be studied
yeah.
more than it is.
Yeah. Get this. This is in states where medical marijuana was legalized, painkiller deaths dropped by 25%. This was from JAMA, August Journal of American Medicine, American Medical Association.
JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association.
I used to subscribe, if you can believe that. I did. And a lot of other
they
journals.
They cut you off, right?
Yeah, they cut me off because I knew too much. But August 25th, I think, of last year, they found that states where medical marijuana can be prescribed, meaning patients can use pot to treat pain, they saw a decline of 25%. 25% fewer people died from opioid overdoses annually. So you're using one – so people are choosing their different kinds of remedies for pain And in this case, this one actually saves lives. But because we demonize substances, we can't address this. It drives me crazy because people suffer for no reason when they could actually solve or at least live happier lives.
I love this point, and I would add to it 2 points. One, make sure when you prescribe medical marijuana, of course, that you have an indication. But the other point is, Greg, this is related to this. What about alternative treatments that we in the mainstream medical world? I mean, what about acupuncture?
Yeah.
You know that there's a new study out that shows that chiropractic cuts down the opioid prescriptions by 55%?
Really?
Absolutely.
That's amazing because I'm not a huge chiropractic guy. I always but you know what it is about chiropractic that always made me skeptical, and you're a skeptical person, is when they say one thing can treat a number of things.
Absolutely.
That always said, like, oh, you know, it's not just back pain, migraine, trigeminal neuralgia. They'll like come up with all of these things, and it's like, no, it's for back pain. And then also people, I think, like to be touched. Like it's a stress relief if you get a massage.
It's a tool.
And
once you have a properly diagnosed back, like you said, massage, to be touched, to do acupuncture, I think manipulations work. Mm-hmm. But the point is, if you're busy getting manipulated for your back, you're not busy saying, "Doc, I need an opioid."
Right.
You know, or if a doctor says, "Hey, this is really a muscle spasm. Let's give you physical therapy, or let's give you a muscle relaxant." You know, that may, or a patch that may actually work.
Yeah.
Too many doctors, like primary care doctors like me, are rushing to the prescription for opioid.
Yeah, it's just I can't take muscle relaxants for some reason. They just make me shaky, and I don't know. And I have other people that it's okay with. And I mean, I'm dealing with, like, I got over my back pain with that Sarno. You know, we've talked about. Is it John Sarno?
Yes, John Sarno is at NYU. Actually.
Yeah. He wrote a book called Healing Back Pain, and you know, I'm not into mind body stuff, but I thought what he did was pretty powerful, and he did it by looking at the stress of his patients and realizing that the back pain and the stress was somehow related, and that by telling yourself not to let the back pain interfere with your life was actually pretty important. It helped me more than stretching, I think.
I think it's right, because the back is a very tight compartment of bone, nerve, and muscle, and the slightest stress to it, and it goes into spasm.
Yeah. So I wanted to. I know that I've kept you on, but I want to talk to you about Obamacare. But I want to add. The search for relief is a human. I don't believe in the search for happiness. I don't believe in the pursuit of happiness because I don't think life is designed to make you happy. It's basically you're on this planet to figure out what it is, and you're on your own. I I think that people should have the right to choose from whatever tools are out there to make them happy. And if there's a risk that those tools might end up hurting you, it's a risk that we all face, whether it's an air travel makes people happier because they can see their family in another country. But there's a risk that plane may go down.
So let me answer that by saying, not to be boring about this, but these are prescription drugs. And only 27% of the time, the person I prescribe is actually the one taking the drug.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So it should be restricted to me because it's a medical drug, because it's a very powerful chemical. But having said that, I agree with you. And one point that you've really made on the program today that I love is that sometimes all of us need to detach from that treadmill we're on, from that world, whether it's through a glass of wine. Who's to judge the person's way of doing that?
Exactly. In fact, I was just going to say, these artificial lines of demarcation, what is an acceptable remedy and what isn't? Like a guy can have bourbon, but or Buddha. He can go and he could meditate, or he could have – but if somebody wants a bong hit, or – and I don't – we talked about pot before. I can't smoke pot. It just it makes me so paranoid.
I get freaked out.
It bums me out because of the people that I know that use marijuana medicinally or recreationally enjoy it, and it helps them, and they're successful. They still do they still go to work, do their jobs, and instead of having a martini, they light up a joint. I can't do that. The moment that happens, I lose control over my body, or I fear I've lost control. It bums me out.
I have the same reaction. By the way, Coca-Cola, started off with cocaine in it.
Yes. What were they thinking? Or what were they thinking when they got rid of it? But then again, that was a delivery mechanism in which the cocaine was probably just enough. So you go, hey, this is great without, you know, you running around and talking about your screenplay for 5 hours, you know, at a bar, boring the hell out of people, which is what cocaine actually does to everybody. So enough about drugs. I want to ask you just briefly about Obamacare, because we talk about Obamacare a lot. And I always ask you for help because I never know. How do you fix it in plain speak? How do you fix it?
Well, you know, it would be nice if it was viewed in medical terms instead of constantly in political terms. I think that's why we're currently in another huge mess with it, which can't be solved, because nobody's thinking what it means for a patient in a doctor's office. You know, nobody realizes, for example, Greg, did you know that the goal of insurance is not to get you taken care of? It's actually to put up a barrier.
Right.
It's like Kafka. Yeah. The goal of insurance is to say you can't. It's to deny something, right?
So how do you put the patient before that? Because, like, when I go to, you know, I know Dr. Siegel, and how you patients are always ahead of everything else. That's, you know, that's your thing.
Thank you.
You're like old school.
Thank you.
You know what I mean?
That's the only way you can enjoy it.
Yeah. But you know? I mean, how do you so you're navigating the maze in order to help a patient, and the patient's on the other side navigating a maze to get help. It's like star-crossed lovers. You can't get them together.
But that maze, listen, that maze is the government and the insurance company. That's what we have to understand. So to have this huge, huge obsessive debate right now about whether pre-existing conditions should be covered, let me answer that for you.
Yeah.
Yes, they should be covered. Yes, nobody should, even in a society where 5% of the people use 50% of the healthcare like America, even in that society, everybody feels that pre-existing conditions should be covered. It's part of being compassionate.
Right.
The question is how you're going to cover it. And I think people need to understand that if they make everybody pay for it in their premiums are going to be sky high.
Right.
If, on the other hand, they create an option where there's a separate pool for it that's heavily subsidized, because that's where government money belongs, our premiums won't be as high.
Right.
It's that simple. The premiums are going to be high if everybody pays the same. And, you know, if you want to talk about compassion, Greg, last point, I'm compassionate for the 26-year-old or 27-year-old who cannot buy a car, who cannot buy a house because he's busy paying for a premium so that a 70-year-old can come see me for a cold every 5 minutes.
How do you make it – like, okay, is it possible to – adapt the free market principles found in other arenas? Like, okay, I turn on the TV. There's a Geico ad. There's a Progressive ad. There's no health insurance ad because they don't have to.
We're captive.
Yeah, exactly. So is it just because health is so unique and so different that you can't apply free market principles to this arena because it's just, I don't know.
I think you can. I'll give you a very quick way you can. Yeah. First of all, let's understand that fear drives insurance, and it's a matter of risk tolerance. So I should be able to say to you, hey, Greg, your emergency room visit should be covered, given.
Yeah.
Right? But maybe if you have a scratch on your ear, you should pay for that out of your pocket.
Right.
Or, Greg, if you keep using your insurance to pay for that scratch on your ear, your premium's going to go up. Whatever happened to that?
Exactly. No, that's how you would – like with car insurance, it's just like a dent. I'm going to take care of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like why can't I don't understand why common sense is left outside that this arena. It's like there should just be catastrophic health insurance for people as a given, and then but everything else. You know, if I go in to see a doc, it's $125 because maybe I go to the doctor 3 or 4 times a year, right? And then you have a premium that takes care of catastrophic. How much would that be? Like if I had
Would be low. That would be hundreds instead of thousands. And then if you're risk averse and you're very nervous, you could pay a higher premium.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, a doctor would always rather see cash than have to beg an insurance policy company to reimburse them.
Yeah.
So let's cover pre-existing conditions, but let's do it in a way where not everybody has to suffer for it in terms of enormous premiums. That's the argument they're not making well enough.
Yeah, it is a small pool. From what I can, I think now
5% of the public uses 50% of the healthcare.
Yeah.
I mean, and we all feel bad for them. It's a compassionate society.
Yeah.
You know, we feel good about being a compassionate society.
Yeah.
But we don't have to attack each other all the time about it.
Exactly. Dr. Siegel. That was like a fast half an hour.
It's a great deal of fun being on with you.
You answer all my questions. I definitely think that I'm going to write a book about about this opioid thing. I feel like it's an interesting topic, and that it's just like – I think I'm going to write a book about substances. Like how substances always get the raw end of every deal.
No, because you defined it brilliantly today, which is that it's a way to check out from the daily routine or the daily
rigor. That's all it
is.
That's all it is.
And we're entitled to that.
Everybody has a right to their own oblivion, and life is hard. And it's like I'm not religious. I'm not religious. I can't pray. I don't go to church. And I don't necessarily believe that a substance is somehow less noble than a book. I just don't see it. And maybe one day I'll change my mind. But it's not happening. So
no, I'm with you. There's nothing – in fact, there's sometimes magical things about substances.
Yeah. Well, and also meditation, which I've been doing, that has been – that is incredibly productive and interesting and hard. But you get some kind of unusual effects from it that I didn't expect, you know?
Like
that,
what?
Close to drug related. Sometimes if you get really, really into meditation and all of a sudden you're kind of like – you're not there.
Connecting to a larger reality.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's like how do you describe it? It is. It's almost though your self goes away. So you're not like the whole point of meditation is to identify thoughts as they're coming and get rid of them so that you have this kind of like blank and then you kind of focus on your breathing and focus on the feelings and then all of a sudden you're not there. That's freaky. I mean, it took me a long time to get to that place, but it's like, holy crap, it works.
Well, you disown the self.
Yes. That's what it is. It's disowning the self. And then once you disown the self, you're kind of like – and it sounds like that old joke about the I want one with everything, the hot dog joke. You're at one with everything. I just ruined the joke by telling the punchline. But you're actually that kind of like cliche of like at one with the universe and it's anyway. But that's another topic for another time.
Sometimes music does that to
yes.
you?
Music does do that. That's the other – we're talking about ecstasy. Like the idea of ecstasy, which you see in religion, meditation, and drugs, and music, that's where you find it, is in that world. That's why it's so popular.
It's beautiful.
Yes. Dr. Siegel, thank you so much for putting up with me.
Great to be on with you.
Thanks, buddy.
We reached the other place.
Yes, we did. Without getting high. Later.